Thank you for listening to this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more teachings or to subscribe to our podcast, as well as information about our congregation, visit our website at forerunnerfellowship.org.
And the title of this is The God That Sees and Hears. And really what this is about is using misunderstanding and mistreatment to gain a better inheritance. And so we're going to be looking at the daily ins and outs, the nitty-gritty of life, and how that relates to the next age, when we are with Jesus in the New Jerusalem, in the Eternal City, and what that looks like, how the things that happen today can actually impact our inheritance for the better. So, just to kind of lay a little bit of a groundwork, a foundation, when I was trying to wrap my brain around what all of this really meant, I really had to take kind of a bird's eye view of this overarching theme, and that really comes down to is being in context, and what happens when we're out of context. So if you think about it, you have a concept, you have a quote, you have a thought, you have an action, something that happens, and normally if there's a bad reaction, it's because it was taken out of context. Now that can sometimes work good, like if you have an inside joke with one of your friends or something like that, or you know, you say a word and it means nothing to no one because it has zero context. But the relationship that you have knows exactly what you're thinking about and all the backstory, and then you have this, you know, good time about it or whatever. And that's the good side. But normally what ends up happening is whenever things are taken out of context, we get misunderstood, we get mistreated, we get just bad things happen, and really what it amounts to is resistance. But what I was thinking of whenever I was applying this to this teaching, it really applies to us as believers. If we're following Jesus, I'm going to go through a couple verses here in just a moment. What it really amounts to is we are completely promised and almost always out of context, being in the world. And so in other words, another way to put it is you're going to have a lot of resistance in the world. You're going to have the least amount of resistance in the context that you belong in. And we don't get to taste that just yet. The cool thing is in context like this, we have a little bit of that. We have the same faith. We have relationships together. And so some of that resistance comes down. And so that it feels nice to be in an area where, you know, you can kind of let your guard down. You know that saying, like, oh, I feel like I let my hair down. And it's like there's less resistance. It feels better. Well, that's that's really good when we have those little blips, but those are just exceptions throughout our life. And the rule is, while we're out in the world, we're going to be meeting a lot of resistance. And so if that's going to be the case, what I want us to take a look at is, what is the Bible's prescription for when we face misunderstanding, and then the various ways that looks in the different degrees. And then we'll look at a few examples as well. So as I began laying out, we are to expect that we're going to be misunderstood and face mistreatment because we're in the world and not of it. We're going to be mistreated because we're foreigners, not forerunners, but we're foreigners. We're foreign to this land. We're sojourners, pilgrims, and we're just passing through. As I stated a second ago, this world has a ruler of its own. It has its own governmental systems. It has its own economy. I mean, all the different things are set up. And what we end up finding is so many times, and even I'm thinking of a couple different Psalms where you see somebody and they're thinking about this person who's in the world. Seems like they have no troubles at all. Their finances are working out. Their job is working out. Their family's working out. Why are they not facing resistance like I'm facing resistance? And then they come to this moment of clarity, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right, because I'm not of this world. I'm in it, but I'm not of it. And there's that moment of clarity, and that's not supposed to be the end of the story, because the extension of that is, oh yeah, I'm not in this world. I'm in it, but I'm not of it. I'm longing for the home, the city that is not made with human hands, but it's builder and maker's God. We're looking to heaven. We're looking to the New Jerusalem. And so as those who are just passing through, we're looking for, we're longing for the coming kingdom, for the coming king, for Jesus to rule and reign. But until that happens, we're going to be facing mistreatment. And Jesus goes so far to say is expect it. And we'll take a look at that verse here in just a moment. It's in John 15, starting in verse 18, if you want to start pulling it up as I'm headed that way. Because all of the different systems are set up for the world. Like I was saying, the government. I find it kind of interesting whenever somebody is really like focused and caught up in government. I don't think politics or government is necessarily bad to think of, but when it becomes primarily the focus or up and above the things that we're supposed to be thinking of, I think it can really put some things out of place and be troublesome for us, because we begin to lose hope, we begin to lose heart, because it's not the end of the story. It's not I'll put it this way, it's not what we were intended to be in. Yes, we're supposed to participate in it, in 1 Peter 2, where we're told, you know, obey and submit to the governmental systems and leaders and things like that. So there's definitely that aspect to it, but whenever it becomes our main focus and what we begin to orient ourselves around, it can be very troublesome, and especially now in our turbulent political climate, it is something that can really distract us, is really the main word there. And so with that all being said, we are a peculiar people, and we should be expected to be treated as such. If you don't fit in, it's probably because you weren't designed to fit in. We get to have these close relationships, and like I said, those things help kind of mitigate that pain that we feel sometimes of being rejected by the world. But we'll see here in John 15, Jesus's take on it. He says this, if the world hates you, I'm in John 15, 18. If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet, because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. And one of the things I just want to point out here is that phrase that he says, I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. If any of you are if you're not the only child of a family, you know that this fight came up between you and your siblings. You're the favorite, aren't you? And there is this finger pointing and accusation. And if you're a parent, you might actually have a favorite, but you can't show it, because that favoritism leads to conflict. And that's really kind of what's going on here, is the world really likes darkness. And when that internal, or maybe even it's something that's obvious, when they know that you belong to God, there's this kind of favoritism, competition, really conflict that ends up happening. And this is what it fleshes out to be. Because God chose us, what that really means is we're his favorite. We're like his favorite child. And the other one is like, I don't like that. The conflict is happening. And then what ends up happening is the persecution and the hate that he said to expect, the misunderstanding, all of those things. And so the reason that we're misunderstood, the reason that we're mistreated, is because of those things. Now, side point, if you're doing weird stuff and just being like intentional to be provocative or whatever, that's why people don't like you. It's not because you're like following the Lord, or, you know, you're exuding the aroma of Christ and it's just so offensive. You might be like just off. And so please don't be off. Be like biblical. That's what we want to do. Being biblical and on its own will get you your own persecution. You don't have to go out of your way to do that. So a little side point there. So with all that being said, if we're going to be facing that conflict, if we're going to be facing that that mistreatment, that misunderstanding, there is a way, and the prescription is that we would become commendable to God. I love this concept of with the potential of being hated by the world, we can become commendable to God. We often there's kind of this interesting position that we can find ourselves in, because the scenario that I just kind of laid out was, well, we're in the world, we're not of it. We're believers, we love Jesus, and so the world is going to hate us. And so that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is we still got some of the world in us. And when we do that and carry that, and then we begin to participate in God's kingdom and try to behave as believers, and then God begins to do things that are part of his kingdom, part of his culture, all of those things, and we begin to kick and go against his ways, we find ourselves in this really bad spot, and that is rejected by the world because we're believers, but also resisting whatever God is trying to do in us and through us, through humility, through building the fruit of the Spirit, through patience and perseverance, and all those kingdom culture things. We find ourselves in this position of being rejected by the world, but also resisting what God is trying to do in us, and we're stuck, and we're not doing it. So that is a bad place to be. We don't want to be willfully kicking against what God is trying to do. So what we have to do is really find out what God's word says about his kingdom, about the culture, about what it is to behave like a Christian, to submit to the process of all of those things and become commendable to God, so that there's at least some comfort from being rejected by the world. We get to experience some of the temporary relief of being commendable to God. But the plus side is, once we graduate, when we get to meet Jesus and when we get to spend eternity with him, our inheritance will be better. And so here's where we're getting to. There's a verse that I want us to take a look at. It's in 1 Peter 2. I'll be starting in verse 18. And this seems so offensive. If we're in that stuck position of rejected by the world, but also resisting the culture and values of the kingdom, it seems so offensive. But if we can look beyond our the lens of viewing things like the world views them, we have an opportunity to be on God's side. It says here in verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable. If, because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongly. For what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. So again, this is kind of that point that I was hinting toward a minute ago. If you're doing something and you get reprimand or consequence for it, that's not like persecution. You can't claim like in the workplace you're a jerk and people you get fired or people are like treating you bad and you're like, oh man, they're just persecuting me because I'm a faithful witness for the gospel. No, it's probably because you're a jerk and you're not like exuding the fruit of the Spirit. You're not bearing good fruit, and that's why you're getting this conflict. It's not because of your awesome fruit and being like Jesus. So again, it says that's not commendable. If you're doing what's wrong and you get consequence, that's what you should expect. That's kind of like your wage. But when you do good and suffer, and if you take it patiently, and I want to talk about what that means, what that looks like here in just a second, that is commendable to God. And so that's our goal. We want to be in the position of being commendable to God, being in God's good graces, especially when it comes to facing suffering, facing trial, tribulation, misunderstanding, threats, mistreatment, all of those things. We want to be able to endure it patiently and then be commendable to God. So some of those things, what it looks like really is holding our tongue. What it looks like is not avenging ourselves. And I've got a whole section that we're going to look at here on not avenging ourselves, but not taking things into our own hands. And I want us to take a look at a couple examples. One of my favorite examples, and this is also when we get to see an awesome revelation of who the Lord is, but of somebody who endured suffering for not doing anything wrong, but for doing good and for suffering, but taking it patiently and being commendable to God. This is in Genesis 15 and going into 16. So I marvel at the way that the Bible describes this story. Granted, Abraham lived a long time, and so whenever it says a sentence and then the next sentence happens to be like, so that period at the end of the sentence is worth like 10, 15, 25 years sometimes. It's like, and then Abraham did this, and then he did this, but there's that gap of like 15, 10, 20 years or whatever. I marvel at how just nonchalantly and just casually it passes over those years of his life of waiting. But in Genesis 15, there is this amazing thing that happens, and the Abrahamic covenant is instated, and God basically does an amazing thing, unprecedented. And what he does is he binds himself to Abram, before he's Abraham, to Abram, and says, "I'm going to give you an heir." He already had somebody in his entourage, in his camp, I guess, in his camp. And it was a non-relative, Eleazar, and he was like, "Is this my relative?" And God's like, "No, I'm going to give you an heir that is going to come from your own body, a son of your own." And so he gives him this promise, and 10 years goes by, and he's waiting and patient. I can only imagine how many times as they're nomads, as they're going throughout the desert and going throughout the different parts of the country, how many times he would renew himself and renew his strength and talk about, "Nope, he said he was going to give me an heir. Let's keep going. We're going to keep going." He's realigning himself. And how many times those things happen, but a decade goes by. And what ends up happening is Abram's wife, Sarai, grows impatient. And what she ends up doing is, she thinks herself and has too many conversations with herself and maybe other people that were with her. What ends up happening is she disqualifies herself. She was not disqualified from the promise, but she disqualifies herself and she gets a surrogate. And in Genesis 16, I just want to go and read it because, man, this story is just... It's worth reading. Let me pull it up. I'm going to go to Genesis 16. You can go there too. So, starts out like this: says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children." This is 10 years after the promise. So 10 years after God swore to himself, swore to Abram, and swore to the death and said, "Abram, I'm going to give you a son to be an heir. And not only that, I'm going to give you more children than you could count. Look up at the stars. If you could number them, that's how many children you would have. I'm going to do something great in you. And it's going to be through an actual son and not Eleazar." So Sarai, she begins to think herself out of it. She disqualifies herself. And it says, she had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now that the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Now, I remember reading this one time and reading it, and I just, this thought of like, no, don't do it. Abram, it's a trap. Bro, you, whatever you're thinking, don't do it. But he heeds the voice of Sarai, and he does. And so what ends up happening is she conceives, and Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gives her to be Abram's wife. And then here in verse 4, it says, he went into her and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. And so this plan really backfired on Sarai. And I just see this. See, okay, so let me just take a step back. I see this as really an advertisement for small groups is what I'm seeing this. Because I'm thinking over the years as people began to be impatient, like if they were in small group and they were having these conversations like, okay, anybody have any updates? And Abram's like, yeah, the camp's a big mess. Why? What happened? I thought you had Hagar. Wasn't she like really good at keeping stuff up? No, Sarai got rid of her. What do you mean? Well, she told me I should like go be with her, and I did. What are you thinking, man? What in the world? When we say updates, this is what we're talking about. You need to have these type of conversations ahead of time. Or on the girl side, you know, Sarai during a small group chat, like, I'm really struggling because this promise that God gave, it's not coming to pass. And I took Hagar and I told Abram to go to be with her. No, Sarai, that's not what you're supposed to do. Like, these are conversations that are supposed to be had in small group to avoid situations. See, this is why we have small group infrastructure, to be able to avoid situations like this. Okay, so we have somebody in our life that can tell us, no, don't do it, Abram. That's a bad idea. Just don't do it. Well, there was no small group there. Abram went and did what he did and heeded the voice of his wife. And she ends up, they get into this huge fight. In verse 5, she says, my wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace. And when she saw that she conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me. And then Abram's like, okay, do whatever you want. Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please. And so Sarai goes off on her. It doesn't say anything that she like beat her or anything, but I kind of think maybe she did. It says Sarai dealt harshly with her. She at least yelled. She at least raised her voice and put the finger in her face, and she fled away. She went from her presence. Now all of that, so Hagar is getting the mistreatment here, and what ends up happening next is one of the most phenomenal revelations, I think, in the Word of God. And it happens to be right after Hagar faces this mistreatment and just eats it. She eats it and takes all of it, and she patiently endured it. So here's what happens in verse 7. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? Reminds me of a song. Where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, I'll multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And then goes on in, to begin to describe what Ishmael and really the people that follow after Ishmael will be like. And so here's the part that is amazing to me in verse 13. It says, then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you are the God who sees. Or in other translations, it says in the Hebrew, El Roy. And what that means is, you see me, you know me as I am. You saw the mistreatment and you came to me. Now here's the part that I recently saw and was kind of blown away by. The name Ishmael actually means God will see. And so in this moment, when she's pregnant, she's out on her own, She just got dealt with very harshly. She ate it. She just took it humbly. And now she's out and about on her own. God comes to her and gives her two revelations, one that's in her already, and then one that he speaks to her, and that is, I'm the God that sees, and I'm the God that hears, and I'm with you. This revelation is persisted throughout the Word of God, and with that being established, we see now that God is not just idle. He's not sleeping. He's actively involved in the things that we're facing. And even an Egyptian woman who was not Hebrew, who was not part of the covenant at that time, well, I guess following Abram, she may have been included by proxy, but what ends up happening is she begins to have relationship with the God that sees and with the God that hears. And so in this example, we see this revelation that we can now take hold of. I want us to take a look at now, with that being established, the fact that God is the God that sees and the God that hears, some advice from Paul here in Romans 12:9. He says this, Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it's written, Vengeance is mine, and I'll repay. So there's this concept that we know very well of whenever we're mistreated. If you ever played the Rock'em Sock'em game, it's like you get the hit and then you go right back. And that's like a lot of times what we end up doing. Unfortunately, many times it happens, and I'm thinking specifically social media in this whole thing. You know, we're misunderstanding and mistreatment, and we're just back and forth. And it's not supposed to be that way. We find ourselves distracted many times, whether it's social media or, you know, real conversations or whatever. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it's written, Vengeance is mine, and I'll repay. Well, the good news is that we have Christ to look at as an example. In the last part of that passage that I referenced earlier in 1 Peter 2, if you're still there, we're going to look at verse 21. We're called to follow Jesus' example when we're misunderstood or mistreated or threatened or whatever, instead of doing the just knee-jerk reaction of you get hit and you just go right back. Of not repaying evil for evil, not threatening, but instead looking to God who judges righteously. And this is the key here. So in verse 21 of 1 Peter 2, for this you are called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. So here we are, we already have it clearly established, laid out. Christ was our example. Now we have an example to follow. Here's what happened in referencing specifically his crucifixion. He who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Now, this was the ultimate test that I believe Jesus had years and years and years of practice and trial runs leading up to this specific moment when Jesus is facing the scourge and facing crucifixion. He had the muscle memory of not repaying evil for evil, not threatening, not reviling whenever he was reviled, but of committing himself to him who judges righteously. We know that in several passages it's established that he has a family, he has siblings, so he has half brothers and half sisters. And if you look at the head count, and if you look at the roll call of the disciples, he didn't have family. He didn't have his brothers and sisters. Later he had one who would be real close to him, and then also near the end, his mother would come and be by his side. But for the most part, I read into this, and the implication that I see is that that Jesus was really misunderstood by his family, by his brothers, and by his own family. And as a young Jewish man growing up and coming into the revelation and understanding that he is the Messiah, that he is God's son, I only see that as problematic. The ultimate, you're the favorite, aren't you? This conflict between siblings. And I just see that as such a problem in the family dynamic. I see that as a reason and for fuel for Jesus to begin to work this muscle of faith and going to God, going to his Father who judges righteously time and time again, knowing that if he took things into his own hands, it wouldn't be done right. Whenever I think of the situations where I've been mistreated or wronged or misunderstood and I try and like avenge myself or I try and make it right, I always overreact or I always like underreact or I go one way or the other. It's done at a wrong time. It's done to the wrong person. I don't have all the information. I always do it imperfectly. I hate when I do it, but I do it so many times. And I want to learn to do this better. I want to learn to go to God just like Jesus did, to the one who judges righteously. Because what ends up happening when we let God do it, this verse here in Romans 12 says, leave place for wrath. In other translations says, leave room for God's wrath. In other words, there's going to be a day when everything is going to be accounted for. Both the good things and the bad things. If we repent for them, it's washed clean. But if we don't, then that's when we have to answer for them. And so what ends up happening is all of those times that we go to God, the one who judges righteously, we're going to have the court date set. And there's going to be a long list of all the times when we said, God, I'm being mistreated right now. I'm turning to you as the one who judges righteously. You make it right. And then in that moment, those things are going to be dealt with correctly, in the right proportion, with all the information laid out. And what we're going to end up seeing is that severity is going to be paid for evil, but kindness is going to be paid for humility. And what this really amounts to is a posture of humility, of saying, I don't have the answers. God, you do. You're the one who's going to judge righteously. And so I want you to do it right. And so if we can train ourselves and begin to work that muscle of faith and turn to the one who judges righteously, I know that we're going to be better off. I want to look at another example, John 13 through 17. We're not going to go through all four chapters, but I want to hit a couple highlights. In this passage, what I find is, and this was really the passage that kind of gave me the understanding of us being in context or being out of context, and that having a direct correlation of how we're treated or mistreated or understood or misunderstood. In John 13, begin to describe the setting of the Last Supper, the iconic painting, the moment that we remember whenever we participate in the Lord's Supper or take communion. And there's this super intimate, close relationship. Jesus and his guys, they're there, and he's going to begin to unfold himself and reveal. This is the way that I say it. He's with those that he chose. Oftentimes when he was around the Pharisees or out in public, he was misunderstood. But he's in this setting, behind closed doors. He's with those that he chose, the guys that he walked with through his ministry assignment. And he comes to this intimate setting during the Feast of Passover, and he's going to reveal himself in the most personal way ever. He's going to reveal, we see in this passage, he reveals to them, I no longer call you servants, but I call you my friends. And he's like, bring them into this closer friendship and relationship. And so he's going to reveal them to himself. Not only that, he's going to humbly serve them in a way that's never been done. He's going to wash their feet, not like the I appreciate feet washing ceremonies, but this was like for real. They probably stepped in like donkey dew on the way in. He's going to wash their feet during this and serve them and give them example. And really what things as I'm going, set the tone. I can imagine, like, I know how much that I pre-think things as I'm going into them. If that's anything like what Jesus was doing, I can imagine Jesus is like thinking, okay, this is the moment that I'm going to set the tone of the culture. I'm going to hand over the keys. I'm handing over the kingdom to my disciples, and I want the tone. I'm going to give them the new commandment to love one another, to know that it's all for love, and I want them to be loving as I love them, and then they can experience love in the way that me and the Father, okay, this is going to be an amazing thing. I'm going to serve them. I'm going to show them humble servanthood. I'm going to show them humility. I'm going to wash their feet. It's going to be a time with just me and the guys. Okay, this is going to be amazing. And so he really sets himself up in the most ideal circumstance and context to be understood. And then he gets misunderstood. I want us to take a look of in this passage. It's the passage in John 15, whenever he's washing their feet and kind of introducing the topic. So he's, like I said, he's going to reveal friendship. They begin talking about the relationship being changed from servanthood into friendship. So there's this new way that he's going to relate to them. On top of this, not only is he going to talk to them about this closer relationship, he also reveals that he's going to send the helper, that he's going to do this amazing thing and send his spirit. He begins to talk to them about the way that the great works that he did with the help of the helper that's to come. They're going to be able to do more than that. We're in John 13. John 13. So this kind of begins to set the context. Verse 4, he rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. And I can just imagine Jesus is like, okay, here I am. I'm going to do the servant thing. I'm going to serve them in truth, not like, not to be showy about it, not to be dramatic or anything like that, but he's doing it to actually serve them. Here I am. I'm going to serve you. I'm going to wash your feet to show you that my kingdom is about love. It's about service. And verse 6, he comes to Simon Peter. And Peter says, Lord, are you washing my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, what I'm doing, you do not understand now, but you'll know after this. Here it is, misunderstanding. So this is kind of the first domino in this kind of multitude of dominoes that ends up falling. And really what this shows is the humanity and a bit of the world that still existed within all of the disciples, and in that place of being rejected by the world, but also kicking against the kingdom culture a bit. And so he begins to describe the reason behind washing his feet and taking part of him, but there's misunderstanding. To add to that, we're not going to go verse by verse for the sake of brevity, but to add to that, later in the chapter, it's revealed that there's a betrayer. Judas is going to betray him. So in the most perfect context that could be set up with those that he chose, he's misunderstood, he's mistreated. There's one who goes out from among him and ends up betraying him. And Jesus himself submits himself to the one who is able to judge righteously. So that's Jesus in his last hours. I'm going to move on and get to the practicals as we get closer to wrapping this up. All this to say is, as Jesus Jesus is met with a bit of arrogance, with a bit of unbelief. We look at Thomas, and then also Philip. We look, there's doubt and accusations and misunderstanding from Peter, and then betrayal from Judas. And he goes to God in the ultimate sense. He goes to God in humility and goes to the one who is able to judge righteously, trusting that God is able to make it right. So now, what does that look like for us when we face threats, misunderstanding, mistreatment, injustice? We too can engage with God in that moment. That is the primary way. If you do it after, it still counts, but the best is to do it right in the moment. And the reality is, yes, we may have coworkers, we may have people out in the world mistreat us, but the reality is we're going to face mistreatment, misunderstanding by our spouses, by our kids, by our parents, by our siblings, by those in our small groups, by those who are in close relationship to us, because we're just imperfect and we don't have all the right information always, because we're fallen, because we get just a little bit of sleep that night, because we're hangry, because whatever. We mistreat each other. It just happens. But we have the opportunity to in the moment, take these situations and really turn to God, and it amounts for us a temporary win, a short-term win, but it also gives us a long-term win, and we're going to take a look at what that is now. So it's really intended that whenever we feel the hurt, the pain, the owie of I'm being mistreated right now, and sometimes we don't recognize it right away. It kind of slaps us in the face, and we're like, oh, snap, I just got slapped. I'm being mistreated right now. And you know, it might take a second to kick in, but we can take that moment to turn to God. And I want to give you a little bit of a dialogue of some of the things that I've been working on to be able to do that. And if we do this, what ends up happening is we get God involved and we come into agreement, we come into alignment with God's, with the way that God runs his kingdom, with humility. And we attain for ourselves a greater inheritance. We attain for ourselves a long-term gain because we're going to be able to stand before him, and he's going to be able to look at us and say, you so many times were mistreated and so many times faced threats or misunderstanding, and you came to me each time knowing that I'm the one who judges righteously. Now let me judge righteously. I account it to you as righteousness. And because it's right, I love this verse in Matthew 24. They will deliver you to tribulation and kill you, and they'll be hated. You'll be hated by all nations because of my name. But then in the Sermon on the Mount, it says, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. So there's the idea in Matthew 24, the persecution. And here's the example of what it will look like. Those who've been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. What this is meaning is we're going to get a greater amount of inheritance. And what that really looks like is closer relationship with Jesus. What that really looks like is a specific assignment. There's verses that say, well done, good and faithful servant. Take charge over 10 cities. We look at what our inheritance is actually going to mean, and what that means is a greater inheritance for us. Yes, it's great treasure, but it's also in the short term and in the long term, greater inheritance of relationship, of intimacy with Christ. And those two things, to me, I call a win-win. So I want to give you a little bit of a dialogue of what that looks like, some of the things that I've been trying to work on, and you can practice this on the smallest amount. If one of your kids does something, if your spouse does something, if they're not even doing it on purpose, but they're mistreating you, like taking the last French fry, or doing something like, I don't know, I'm running out of all the examples that I, Just think about the last time your spouse mistreated you, or a friend mistreated you, or somebody in your small group mistreated you, or the last time somebody misunderstood something that you were trying to say, and it was like, I didn't even mean to say that. I run into this all the time because, as I've explained to many, I have difficulty sometimes emoting, and really it's like, I'm so excited right now, but my face is hiding it. And so when you're telling me my wife is giving me the amen back there. Whenever something is exciting happening, it's like party on the inside. I'm just not showing it. And many times that comes off like, I don't care. And that's totally not the case. I really care about the exciting thing that you tell me about. I promise. I just don't show it well, and I'm getting better at it. I promise. But whenever we're misunderstood or mistreated or threatened or whatever it is, we can go to God, and here's the dialogue that I've come to. So you're mistreated, the fry gets taken, or you're misunderstood, you get slapped, your tires get slashed, you get counted out, you get overlooked, you feel left out. Here's what the dialogue looks like. God, you see me and you hear me right now, in this moment. Look on this fill in the blank. Look on this misunderstanding, on this mistreatment, on this threat, whatever. You judge righteously, so I'm not going to take it into my own hands. I give it to you. Now here's the important part, and this was one that Jesus majored in. Forgive them. He's on the cross. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. This is such a crucial part that we can add to this mix. Forgive them. I forgive them. Help my heart. And I found this, and I've been practicing this a bit whenever I'm facing the mistreatment. God, you see me, you hear me. Look at this thing that's happening right now. You see it, and you understand all the context, all the backstory of why this has affected me. And I know that you judge righteously, so I'm not going to take it into my own hands. I give it to you. Forgive them, I forgive them, and help my heart. Just the other day, on Tuesday, was Anna's birthday. She was facing some mistreatment by some of those who are closest to her. And on her own birthday, she was being left out and facing mistreatment. And I just felt so bad for her. But I had all of this fresh in me, and so I went over to her, and she's just like trying to hold it together. But her face is, she's really showing her emotion. And she's like bubbling, like about to cry and stuff. And I went and put my arm around her, and I'm holding her, and I'm like, Anna, I said, right now we can turn to God, and we can give this to the Lord, and I want to help you through this. So I basically walk her through this, and I say, God, you see Anna right now. You see it. You hear this thing. You see her being left out. You hear her being left out. Look at this injustice right now. Look at this hurt that she's feeling. And I know that you judge righteously. We want for you to take care of it. We're not going to take care of it. We're not going to go and reprimand the people. We're not going to go and correct the people. We're not going to go and repay evil for evil. We're going to give it to you. Now, the cool thing was, I don't remember if I shared this or not, but last Sunday, we were in worship time. She was over there dancing. And she came up to me, and she said, Dad, she said, Daddy, actually. She doesn't say Dad. She goes, Daddy, the Lord gave me a word, and she said, grace and peace. He told me grace and peace. I was like, that's amazing. Last Sunday, I prayed with her, and we were like, Lord, we agree, grace and peace. And so I referenced that moment on Tuesday during her birthday, and I was like, the Lord gave you a word, grace and peace, ahead of time. So let's just pray into that right now. We're going to agree. So I'm hugging her, and I'm like, Anna, we speak grace and peace right now. God, give Anna grace and peace, and you judge righteously. We're not going to take it into our own hands. We give it to you. We forgive them. Help Anna right now. And I just waited and let her. I was like, Anna, we're just going to wait and listen if the Lord has something to say to you or whatever. So we're just going to wait. And so we waited there for just, 90 seconds or something like that. And I'm hugging on her, and I look down at her. I'm like, Anna, did you hear anything from the Lord? Did anything happen? She said, yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. What happened? She said, I felt the Lord's hand on my hand. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to start crying myself. This is amazing. Like, God, who sees and hears, met her in that moment. And what I really want to do is give this to her as a tool, as a way of life. And she's already beginning to experience it in real time. She has the mistreatment by some people who are just so close to her. And of course, she loves him and forgives him, but that doesn't take the pain away. She's feeling the rejection. She's feeling the mistreatment. And beginning to train our hearts to, in that moment, God, you see it, you hear it, you are with me right now. I'm not going to take it into my own hands. I'm going to deal with it patiently because I know that you judge righteously. Now, you do it. I forgive them. And what this does is it frees us from bitterness. It frees us from unforgiveness, which is such a hindrance to so many things. It awakens this connection of intimacy and closeness with the Lord that we can know that he's with us. And then the bonus for Anna in this moment was the Lord came and actually gave her a touch that she could feel. And it was amazing to see her in that moment have this marking point in her life of, I had rejection, I had feelings of hurt and heartbreak, and the Lord met me. I know that he sees and I know that he hears. And we have to know that these things are coming. Yes, it'll come from the world, but oftentimes it's going to come from those who are closest to us, and we have to expect it. Jesus was misunderstood, and he did this, and he gained such a great inheritance, and we're called to do the exact same thing. So with that, I want to give us a moment to respond. If we're able to play some music, that's great. But if we're not, that's fine too. But what I want us to do, I want us to get into a posture of receiving. If that's standing, if that's sitting, if that's pacing, whatever. We're just going to take like 2 minutes. And what I want us to do is think about any hurt right now, any pain, any rejection, any misunderstanding, any mistreatment, any of that ouch that may be carrying a residue on us. And I just want to walk us through this. If you're already a pro at it, let this be just another rep at repetition at going through this. But if this is new, I want us to begin to build a foundation of this. I believe it's powerful. I've seen it work in my own life, and I'm beginning to see it work in my family.
This concludes this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more information about our congregation, visit forerunnerfellowship.org. Thank you.